Yeah. Yeah, no beating around the bush. No. Thought I had a couple of minutes to collect my thoughts there. My name's Chuck, and I'm an alcoholic. I haven't had to take a drink since May the 3rd, 1994, thanks to Grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous. My home group is an experience you must not miss. It's on Wednesday nights at 7 o'clock in downtown George's Tavern, Virginia. You'll need a map to get there. And I have a sponsor. I spoke to him today. He's recovering from surgery, or he would have made the trip with me. And point being that we talk pretty regular. I've been sponsored almost without interruption since I got sober. There was a couple of changing the seats on the bus there where momentarily I wasn't sponsored. But that's been a very big part of my sobriety. Last time I spoke, I told them that I wasn't nervous. I was just a bad speaker. And that was somewhat of a lie. I don't do this often enough not to be just a little bit nervous about it. But I'll get into it here. And I'm sort of an introvert type person, which can get me going. It really rolls on out. And there is very few things in this world I know much about. Alcohol is one of the things I know quite a bit about. And sobriety, thankfully, is also something I know a little bit about. And just to give you an idea, and I really didn't think this out too much, but I was thinking that, you know, we really don't recognize the miracles that we see just about every day in AA. And I'm going to tell you just a few snapshots out of my life recently. And I want you to keep in mind as I tell my story those snapshots. One is, it's actually many snapshots. Every morning, usually my daughter and I get up earliest. And she's 4 years old, and she likes a sippy cup of milk. So her and I get in the recliner chair where we can see the sun coming up. We just quietly sit there. She sips her thing, and I do my coffee. And we may speak a few words, but usually not. And the other one involves last spring, I found myself responding to a forest fire. And I got there, and I had several acres of very hot fire. She was blowing up on me pretty bad. And I've had a lot of training to deal with this sort of thing. And I was in charge. And before it was all over with, I had 30 men, several bulldozers, I had aircraft making water drops, I had the state police shutting down the highway, and I was about to shut down the airspace because the news crews were starting to show up. And I fought that fire for 6 hours and never thought once about it. I was just, you know, directing, sizing things up, making decisions. A lot of training went into it. The people who I work for had spent a lot of money on me being able to do that day. And later on when I got home and you had a chance to think about what you did all day, this is on a Sunday, you know, you wake up Sunday morning, you go out and you do that, and it's just sort of shocking. And it was just awesome to me that somebody would trust me to do that. Would give me the millions and millions of dollars worth of equipment and a couple dozen lives and say, here, go get this task done. And any wrong decision on my part would cost people their homes, could cost people their lives. And contrast that to what you're about to hear. And you got to recognize the miracles that we see all the time. And what I have in my life right now is nothing short of a miracle. And the one thing that I see in AA virtually all the time, a little less out in these country groups, but because we have less people, but we watch people get sober every day that are hopeless. And I was hopeless when I got here. I don't remember my first drink. Somebody gave me something to sip on, I guess. I do remember the first time that I got enough together to really make it worthwhile. you know, we were into somebody's liquor cabinet, and we didn't know dark liquor from light liquor or whatever. We just threw it all into a highball and downed it, and woke up in the bathtub fully clothed, just covered in puke. And it never changed much after that. And didn't, you know, that did not discourage me a whole lot at all. I had, you know, some pretty severe symptoms right from the beginning. I was a very difficult teenager. I got these 2 4-year-olds. If there is payback, I'm really in for it here. My parents, I had a really good family, really good parents. And I think they realized early on about all they could do is love me and sit back and watch the train wreck. And that's pretty much what they did. And I got arrested for the first time. I was 15, I think. And I was urinating on the statues down at the state capitol in Richmond. And I was arrested. I didn't know they have a barracks of state troopers right there to guard the governor. And they're looking out their window, and there I am going. I guess they thought I was a threat to the governor or something. My family did pretty much what you're all doing. It was right funny. It's, you know, they made folks come get me and take me home, and there's a few little dings there from the folks, but it was, everybody thought it was pretty funny. And in the years to come, it wasn't funny because it got worse and worse. And I would, as a teenager, would just disappear for days at a time, and I was already hardcore drinking. I did manage to get some college degrees, and for most of my drinking career, I had a very strong work ethic instilled into me, and I would show up for work, and I would do my job, and no matter how bad I felt, I would show up and do that, and so I, you know, my early employment was not affected by the alcohol, and early on, and I've had this all my life, I've always, I think a lot of alcoholics are like this. I really wanted to just grab life by the tail. I really wanted to do everything there was to do and do it as hard as it could be done. And I was just frothing at the mouth to live life. And it was my belief that alcohol would help me do that. And it did for quite some time. It took me places that I probably wouldn't have gone. It met people that I probably wouldn't have met. And alcohol really seemed to be the answer for the kind of life I wanted to lead. And early on, there weren't the continuous stream of disasters. I would drink, just pull a number out here, 30 times before something bad would happen. Or 20 times before something bad. Bad, I mean, I don't know, getting a fist fight with a friend or break up with a girlfriend. Or a little later, started getting all the drunk arrest type stuff. And wrecking cars. I was pretty good at wrecking cars. And but it wasn't every time. You really couldn't connect the dots and say that alcohol is causing this all this problem here. Most of my drinking buddies, and that's the key phrase there, just told me I had bad luck. And I felt like they were probably right. I just had extremely, but it's pretty consistent bad luck. And it got more consistent as time went on. And by the end of my drinking, about every drunk was a disaster of some sort or another. And it, by the end, there was no fun left at all. And I'm not quite sure when that happened. Early in my drinking career, I was the kind of guy you would love to have at your party. Fun-loving, you know, joking, just having a good time. By the end of my drinking, I mainly drank alone, and I was just full of anger and hate. And I'm not quite sure where that switched at, but that at the beginning it was one way, and at the end it was another. And the alcohol did that to me in the life I was living. I would say by the time I was in my early 20s, some serious stuff had started to happen. There was one car accident in particular that I shouldn't be here. When I tell you all those miracles, I was thrown out of the passenger side of my car doing 90 miles an hour as it turned over. And had a concussion. That was it. And just kept right on doing what I was doing. I shouldn't be here. Should not be here. And there was a multitude of things like that. And when you live that kind of life, you know, the people around you are not so lucky. And, you know, friends of yours dying, and, you know, things are happening to them. And you're not connecting. I wasn't connecting. You know, the alcohol's the common denominator here. And most of my life I had judges and cops and jailers and lawyers and family telling me that I had a problem. and didn't buy into it one little bit. You don't know. You don't understand. You know, it's not the alcohol. The cops are out to get me. They don't like rednecks and pickup trucks, so they pull them over all the time. And and the other thing was the lies that you tell yourself about the drinking. I did a lot of that. I got my first DUI. I'm going to date myself here. 81, maybe. It's Christmas Eve. I'd been in town for 3 days. None of my family had seen me. I was on a three-day bender. I was very early on having blackouts, pretty extreme blackouts, and they would sometimes be extended. And I passed out behind the wheel and hit a parked car, 68 vintage condition Mustang, total those vehicles. And I was up there around the .3 range. And it's Christmas Eve, and they threw me in jail. And my brother was an attorney in that county, and they sent him down there to get me, and he plays golf with the magistrate. So they lead me out of the jail cell, and I'm shackled to these two other guys, you know. And they're changing on. Here's my brother with his feet propped up on the magistrate's desk talking about golf, and they lead me in. It's like 2 o'clock in the morning, Christmas morning. And I've ruined the whole family's Christmas. And I'm all cut up and scraped. And it just, you feel about this doll, you know. And I can't tell you how many times that kind of stuff happened. And the blackouts were pretty scary. And again, you know, when you're trying to figure out, you know, I really wrestled with whether I was alcoholic when I was first getting sober. Really, hope against hope was hoping that I wasn't. But the kind of things I tell you now is pretty darn obvious, you know. And a person who is non-alcoholic, God, that ain't going to happen again, you know. I'm just not going to drink no more. I woke up one morning at my parents' house, and the sheets are covered with blood. And there's automobile glass all embedded in my body. And I got up, and I got the sheets up so nobody would see them. And I picked all the glass out of me and mopped myself up to where I didn't think anybody would notice it. Went downstairs, you know, just sort of walking on eggshells like, oh, the shoe's going to fall here any minute, because I didn't have a clue why I was like that. And somehow or another found an excuse to go outside and look at my vehicle, and not a scratch. And the rest of the day is calling around, did you see me last night? And to this day, I have no idea. Got no idea what happened. And did not strike me as an unusual thing. It was a little embarrassing, you know. You don't want to come right out. You know, I woke up soaked in blood this morning. I was sort of wondering why. Could you help me, you know? And I'm just going along my merry way, just thinking there is not a problem with me and alcohol. And went on through college and started working. And I eventually did lose a job toward the end there. I was fired. The guy sent me to a convention in Canada, and I ran up a $700 bar tab on the company credit card. He was less than sympathetic. He gave me, made me take my leave and gave me 30 days to get cured. That's how he put it. And I went to my first AA meeting. I had a friend of mine's wife that I knew was in AA. I went to an alcohol counselor and got him to write me a letter saying that I was an alcoholic, which was not hard to convince him of that. And went to the AA meeting. It was a speaker meeting such as this. Couldn't wait to get out of there. Did not want to be there. Don't remember a thing about it. Do remember the speaker. Got to hear her years later. Actually listened that time. But didn't want to be there. Got on out of there. Went back with my signed stuff, and the guy said not good enough, and he fired me. So I did lose a job there. I did lose significant others over the years. And usually the way I mainly would want to date women who were either alcoholic themselves or came from alcoholic families, so that they'd be less likely to pitch a fit about my drinking. I didn't consciously make that decision. It just, that's what it did. And eventually they would begin to express concern about my behavior. And I would start to find some reason why this wasn't going to work. And you had to go. Because you were, you know, and in hindsight, you were getting between me and the drink. And I wasn't going to allow that. And the drink got more and more important to me. I did notice the lack of control, just casually notice it. As I got into my late 20s and early 30s, I was a connoisseur of bars. And I'd like to go around and check out all the atmospheres and stuff like that. And I had a couple of bars that I liked to go to. And I lived on a remote farm at that time. And I was drinking daily by then. And I'd gone through what I called my bourbon years, where I drank all bourbon. And that about killed me. It's ruined my stomach, and I still have problems with it today. And I had to back off of that. It was just too painful. And but I was still, you know, drinking whatever I could tolerate there. And I would go, I'd get off work, and I'd go to a bar, and I'm going to have three. For some reason, the magic number was always three. And very rarely did I have three. And I would find myself at closing time going, you know, and I'd have something like important the next day. The book describes me perfectly when it talks about that. I would have some reason I needed to go home early and be well rested for the next day, something important task to do. And I'd intend to stop for three, and I'd be closing the place. And there was always a good reason. You know, Frank came. I ain't seen Frank in a long time. John bought me a beer last week. I got to buy him a beer. And it'd be 2 o'clock in the morning there. I'd be soused going like, how'd that happen? And it happened repeatedly, and I took notice of it. Didn't want to do anything about it, but I did. You know, how come I can't go in there and have three? And every once in a while, on a rare occasion, I would only have three. But I would take some home with me. But every once in a while, I could pull it off. Yeah. Earlier on, it started to progress on me pretty fast. There was some pretty ugly stuff happening there, and my circle of acquaintances started to shrink. These bars I was going to, mainly I wanted to go to the bars where you could fall off the stool and they wouldn't cut you off. And I was usually drinking with a room full of I would say that I was going to meet women, but there weren't many women in these bars I was going to. And I wouldn't talk to anybody most of the time when I went. I would sit in a bar all night and not talk to anybody. And that's the other thing that began to happen. If you guys are alcoholics, and to me, this is a good way to tell if you're alcoholic. If there's an alcoholic up here talking, this happens to me every time. Now, I've heard a lot of people speak that I got nothing in common with. I mean, they just didn't come from where I come from. They don't think the way I think. But they're alcoholic, and they're telling their story. I know that at some point during that story, I'm going to get like little goosebumps. And, you know, and that's the language of the heart, I guess. I'm going to connect sometime during the story. And so if you get the little goosebumps, you're probably alcoholic. But I sort of skipped around. I lost my place. Where was I? The falling off the bar stool type stuff. I drank mainly with these guys who were 20 years my senior. And I remember sitting there with them. I'd be sitting there on right about now on a Sunday afternoon, you know, and I'd be 10 sheets in the wind, and I'm looking at all these old guys. Man, when I get their age, I ain't going to be sitting around rotting like this. And it occurred on after I got sober, you know, I'm already there, you know. I'm 20 years younger than them. I'm already there. And they taught me a lot. They sort of take care of you, you know. And the thing about not talking in the bar is when I got sober, the only emotion left to me was anger. That's the only thing that I had left. And it had been quite some number of years before I felt any other emotion. The world had gotten very small till there was just me in it. And that's all I worried about, and that's all I did anything for. I was pretty good at faking an expression of sympathy or help or generosity or something like that, but I pretty much, there were some things that alcohol sort of killed in me. And one of those was any ability to have normal emotion. And it was almost like pathological. I really could watch something horrible happen to you and would have no effect on me whatsoever unless it involved me. And to give you an example, I had a roommate who killed himself one time. And he blew his head off with a shotgun. And he was a Frito-Lay salesman. And the week that he died, it was a couple weeks before Frito-Lay came and got their truck. So I'd be, you know, alcohol and other substances that give you the munchies. And my biggest worry was how to get into that snack truck. God, he found and left an extra key around here somewhere. And, you know, this guy, I've known him all my life, and that's what I'm worried about, how to get into his truck so I can have some munchies. And that's come back to haunt me. You know, I've had to revisit him and his death and his life and everything like that. I didn't know why he killed himself. I do now. Because I got there myself at the end. And I've watched that very same thing. One guy, a sponsor, decided to do that. I'm really touchy about the whole suicide thing. It's the most selfish act we can do. And if I was to define my own alcoholism, it's self-centeredness. The whole thing was driven by self-centeredness. Every bit of it was to provide myself with what I thought I needed or deserved or otherwise. And I didn't really realize that. And the other thing I didn't realize, and this came out in my first four step, the anger. I just eat up with it. You know, when I read in the big book that resentment was the number one offender and it would kill you, I had no trouble believing that at all. Resentment just ate me up. I lived it day in, day out, all day. And it eats up all your energy. And I just had a horrible time getting rid of any of that. And the one thing, and it was 3 years into sobriety before I shed a tear. I had stuff going on around me that normal people would be shedding tears, and I couldn't do it. I desperately wanted to, because I knew it was part of my illness. And it's like, I want to be normal. Please let me experience normal emotions. And I really couldn't. But the thing that I write down is my first spiritual experience was some of that started to come back to me. Not the tear part of it, but I started to care about other people. And that very early on, even before I was able to put a cork in it, was Alcoholics. I finally got DUI number 3. I had a bunch of other stuff in there, different offenses. But I got DUI number 3. And really ticked off the Commonwealth's attorney, but I missed being a habitual offender by a couple of days. And so he couldn't get me on that. But they sent me to the advanced course of ASAP. And I got a friend of mine that's a counselor in another town that does the ASAP classes, and she always gets me to come to speak to the advanced ones. You know, those advanced guys, there's a high percentage of alcoholics in that group. And I know exactly what they're thinking. And I can see it on their face when I go to talk to them. How does he know that? You know, and it's because I've been there. And so I was had to attend 15 AA meetings. That's pretty severe, you know. And I had no intention of doing it, except the instructor was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he did not get you to sign any sort of form. What he had you do, which meetings you go to, what corner of the room is the coffee pot in? You know, and if you weren't there, he knew it. And then I'm like, there's no way around this. I got to go. And I started going, and I've never stopped. I didn't get sober. By this time, I was, 35, I guess. And I knew I was in trouble. I knew I was alcohol. I knew it was killing me. I was pretty sure that it was going to be an ugly death, but probably I wasn't going to live too long. And really was sort of all right with that. And so I end up in AA, and I'm sort of looking for an answer. And the lie that was really debunked there was all my life I told myself that I could quit if I really wanted to. And that's a lie that all good drunks tell themselves. We just don't want to. And I wanted to. I wanted to start. I knew it was killing me. Like I was telling you before, I've always had a zest for life. I wanted life. I wanted to live. I had experienced joy in my life. I wanted to experience it again. And the only way to do that is to keep living. And I really wanted that, but I was out of it. I tried all this stuff. And willpower, my personal willpower, was my fallback. And it had served me well in most of the things that had happened to me in my life, but it failed me completely with alcohol. And I was hopeless. I was just totally hopeless. And pretty much there, I'd worked my first step. You know, when I came into AA, court-ordered, I was already at that point. And I was 6 months drunk in AA then. I started coming to the meetings. One of them was really neat. There was almost a fist fight. My sister was, I couldn't drive very often. It was sort of iffy there at the beginning. And she would drive me to the meetings and sit out in the car and read a book. And there was one of the JPA noon meetings. There was a man and woman in there that didn't care for each other. And they about started throwing stuff at each other. And the meeting broke up with people storming out of there. And I just thought that was so cool. You know, and it was entertainment, you know. But I really started connecting with what people were saying in the meetings. And I didn't really want your help, but I was going to still stick around and get a few pointers, you know, and sort of kick this thing on my own. And what was going on then was the same hideous thought kept tripping me up. And I'm like, all right, all my willpower. Going to do it this time. Going to do it, going to do it, going to do it. And I get 2 days, you know, and I'm really jumpy after 2 days. And my mind starts thinking. And it's like, you know, you really overreacted. You can have a couple. And I'd go on a bender. And I'd come off that bender, and now I'm really determined. Now I know the score here. We're really going to tighten up. And I'd try my hardest. Same little thought. Overreact. You can have a couple. Worse bender than the one before. Did this for 6 months. Was heading downhill quick. I'd been showing up at my doctor with the different alcohol-related stuff. One of the things that came out of my alcoholism is you know, some people go to depression. I was the other way. I was anxiety-ridden. I started having severe panic attacks and that kind of stuff. And she loaded me up with every kind of drug there was. None of it had any effect because I was drunk at the South all the time. And it could have been sugar pills for all I knew. The only one that I really liked was Valium. A couple of them and a six pack did me good, you know. Could function there. And she gave me a little prescription, and I called her up and I said, "Need some more?" And she goes, "I'm not giving them to you." And I said, "Why not?" And she says, "Well, they're highly addictive." And I'm like, "I don't care, you know. You have my permission to addict me to value." You know? They're cheap, they work, let's go with it, you know. And she wouldn't do that, and that's more on her coming up here. Because I started showing up at her office, and she pretty much had my number. She used to do stuff like, how much do you drink a week? So, you know, I'm stuck trying to figure out what is a normal drinker drinking a week. You know? 2 6-packs a week, you know, does that sound about normal? I don't know. And she'd go on and poke and prod a little bit, and a little while later she'd come back and say, "How much did you drink a day?" And I'd 6-pack a day, you know. Number. She'd trip me up. Numbers didn't add up. You know? So she had the score there. And my last drunk, I was really getting bad off. I was drinking huge amounts on these benders. The benders were getting worse. I was at the end of the road. It wasn't. I didn't have long. And I've seen people in that same spot before, and most of them don't make it. Most of them go ahead and go down for the count. And my last drunk was 3 days long. It's down somewhere south of Roanoke, and involved moonshine. And I don't remember 5 minutes of it. And I'm on my way back to Charlottesville, and the left side of my face and my left arm go numb. And so I'm making an emergency appointment with this doctor. And I go in there, you know, and my heart rate's up through the flush red. And she quit beating around the bush. She said, "I give you 2 years. Is the max that I give you. And that's if you don't do something foolish. And that means kill myself, because, you know, that's the other way." And she told me that, "I implore you to do whatever it is you have to do to quit drinking. Please leave my office." And she kicked me out of her office. And I bless her for doing that, because that took away one more crutch. And the only thing I was left with was AA. And so I went to it, and I had to decide whether I wanted to live or die. And I decided I wanted to live. And this is very important. I came to the decision I was going to keep doing stuff until either I got sober or I was dead. And I didn't care whether it was AA or anything else. And this went so far as to have myself locked up in a psych unit. I would do whatever it took to quit drinking. I did not think for a second that I'd pull it off. I was pretty sure I was going to die drunk, but I was going to try whatever was in front of me. And if I did this thing and it didn't work, I was going to go to the next thing available and do that. I was going to go to the next. And I developed that attitude. And I came back to AA. I never left. I was still in AA. And there were several people in AA who I thought I was fooling them, but they pretty much knew what was going on with me. And I came back with that attitude. And there had been a man I'd been talking to that I sort of liked talking to him because I could tell he drank like me and looked like the same as me. And so I asked him to sponsor me. And I guess I was maybe 5 or 6 days into it, and it's coming unglued. And I had real bad... one of the things that used to happen to me drinking, and this is what one of them old men helped me with, I used to wake up 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning with this incredible sense of impending doom and just dread, night sweats, I don't know what you call it. But, and you couldn't put a finger on what it is you're afraid of, but you wake up 2 o'clock in the morning, your heart's racing, and it's just like you just sure something terrible is about to happen. And so I shared with the old guys at the bar about that, and they're like, oh, yeah. And just get up and have a couple beers. You'll be all right. And I just did that and never even thought about it. You know, that's actually the physical addiction caught up with me. And my body ran out of booze at 2 o'clock in the morning. And it's waking me up to let me know that. And the old man's answer was, go ahead and put it in there and you're fine, you know. And I did that. And that was years before I got sober and just accepted that that's the way people slept, you know. And I had all these problems when I quit drinking. I mean, I had the anxiety. The panic attacks were horrible. I could not sit all the way through a meeting. I smoked cigarettes back in. I had to sit on my hands. I was just shaking like a leaf. And I couldn't sit all the way through. I just would get this panic in an AA meeting. And I would have to go outside and smoke a cigarette. And then I'd come back in and sit for as long as I could. And then I'd go back out. And it was just horrible. And the alcohol, I knew... Then when one of those panic attacks, I could drink it away temporarily. Because it worked for me before, and I couldn't do that anymore. And at 6 days, I was just coming unglued, and I called up my sponsor. This ain't working. Y'all sold me a bill of goods. You know, this is just not working for me. I'm going to go ahead and go back to drinking and go back to the life I had. And, you know, I ranted and raved and all that kind of stuff. And he's like, well, good enough. He said, there's a meeting tonight at 7:30. He said, if you would you come there and raise your hand and tell everybody else this too? And then, by golly, go on out there and drink. And so I did that. I went into the 7:30 meeting, waited for all the preliminaries to go through. Hand went up, you know, and angrily told everybody that AA may work for you, but don't work for me. I must be some other species. And they spent the rest of that hour telling me why I didn't have to take another drink. And I haven't had one since then. And really threw myself into the program early on. I got that sponsor. Just an incredible guy. He had 20-some years of sobriety. He had worked the steps before, but it had been a while. And he just gave of himself. He was just around for me all the time. And I forced him to do the steps. I was just biting at the bit to get some sort of solution to my problem. And I had at that point, I think, accepted both step 2 and 3 there. That there was going to be a solution and I needed to, it wasn't my will, because my will had failed. And I did not have any belief in God at that time. But I was willing to let somebody else guide me. And so I did, and we started working the steps. I joined a home group and just became Mr. Service. This meeting at that time, had 5 meetings. And I was setting up for 2 or 3 of them, and everything thing that needed a volunteer. I was like, eh, and after a while, you know, the home group, you can't take all that on, you know, you back off. I had a driver's license. I could go from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. for worker AA only. And a lot of days I had to decide, is it work or is it AA? And, you know, you get those Social Security earnings things from the government that shows your earnings for different years. Great big goose egg in 1994. And the best investment I ever made. You know, I lost tens of thousands of dollars in income by just going to AA all year. And, you know, and keep in mind that opening thing about the miracles and stuff. This is where I was at. Nobody was going to leave me in charge of anything. Nobody was asking me to do anything. I had one or two really tight drunk buddies, and that was all that was in my life at that time. The family was out there, but I kept them as far away from this disaster as I could. And I usually, in the last of my drinking, had maybe 2 or 3 hours of non-drunkenness in a day at the most. And I was usually pretty much wasted by noon. And I could usually squeeze 2 drunks in a day, drink, pass out, get up and do it again. And but I'm in AA and I'm doing it all. And it was not pleasant the first years. I had like protracted withdrawal. I couldn't sleep. I'd either sleep 48 hours or not sleep for 72 hours. I had tension headaches all the time. And, you know, found out that this is like gasoline on panic attacks, right? Because I was drinking boatloads of coffee. Yeah, a couple of years. Well, you might cut down on the caffeine. Maybe that'll help. And my doctor, you know, and this may be a little controversial, but she had told me that I had a chemical imbalance in my brain. And I'm like, well, duh, you know. There were a lot of chemicals went through my body, alcohol and otherwise. And she wanted to keep doing the thing for the panic attacks. And I really, at that point, it's gotten sort of militant about that. I wouldn't take an aspirin unless I really, really had to. And so I just ignored her advice, and but I was suffering. And I remember I shared about it in a meeting, and some woman came up to me afterwards, and she had long-term sobriety, and she's one of these people I really admired, and she was actually my future wife's sponsor. And she told me I had the same thing, and it lasted for several years into sobriety. You just do the stuff you're supposed to do, and it'll go away. And I found that to be true. It did. And I haven't had one of those in many, many a year. And right away, the thing about feeling for others, and I'm going to try to speed this up a little bit, because suddenly I have a lot to say. when I came into AA on that ASAP thing, there was these meetings. I found out I had to go to meetings, so I started going to certain meetings. And I was sitting out in front of them one day, and I was a chain smoker, and I'm sitting out there smoking. And this guy comes walking up the walk, and I'd recognized him from having been at meetings before. And he looked horrible. He just looked horrible. And, you know, again, remember, I have no real human emotion as we think of it. And so I say, hey, how you doing? Didn't mean it. You know, just supposed to say that, you know. And he said, I'm not doing well. He goes, I've been drunk for several days, and I have a history of seizures, and I think I'm about to go in one. And I got to looking at him, you know, and I'm like, I have felt like he looks. I have felt just exactly the way he looks. And I had empathy. And I didn't know what to do with him. But I just sort of wanted to sit down, you know, and I was talking real gentle to him and trying to help him through it. And I looked and I saw a couple of, you know, real AAs coming up the walk. So I went over there and told them what was going on, and they took him to the emergency room. I started to care for other alcoholics. There's a bunch of people that got sober at the same time as me. You know, you sort of group together, you know, because you're all about the same level. And I started caring about them. One by one, they all went back out, and I was heartbroken as they did so. Or, you know, I'd feel something. I wouldn't sit there and weep or anything. But then the day came that my sponsor, probably 6 or 8 months into sobriety, he fell 40-some feet off of a roof. And he ended up in the ICU over here at UVA, and they didn't expect him to live. And somebody chases me down in a meeting and tells me about that and had absolutely no reaction whatsoever when they told me. And they're all looking at me. Well, I guess I'll go see him. You know, it's expected of you, you know. So I went down there and I lied and told him I was his brother and got into the ICU, and he's unconscious and he's hooked up to all of these machines and whirring and beeping, and I'm sitting in there like, God, what? How long is appropriate? You know, I got stuff to do, you know. The selfishness, man, I'm telling you. And whenever I think that I'm not alcoholic, that's still in me. I catch it sometimes, you know, little glimpses of it. It's still there. And so I'm sitting there, you know, like, and all of a sudden I looked at him, and all he'd done for me in that 6 months, and I just suddenly really, really overwhelmingly cared whether he lived or not. And it was really shook me up. You know, I'm just like, what is that? And that is what I call my first spiritual awakening. It's a change in the way you feel and act and think. And that occurred right then and there. And I started to go on 12-step calls, not because anybody was coming to me for help. We'd be in a meeting like this, and as it broke up, two or three guys, you come with us. And I'd go with them. And I was telling Billy earlier in the fight, I think they wanted me for muscle. You know, come along, don't say anything, just do what we do. And, you know, we'd go into some place, you know, usually some dingy little thing with some guy that's in pretty bad shape, and I'd just stand in the background, you know, and then we'd escort him wherever we were taking him, you know. And some of those 12-step calls, they were pretty nasty. And, you know, I'm still sitting there at 6 months playing with the idea that I've made a mistake, that I need to go back to my previous life. And nothing I saw on any of those 12-step calls was remotely appealing and drawing me back into it at all, you know. And really, I wasn't anywhere near 12-stepping anybody, but it did me a world of good to see it. And I guess after a year or two, things started to settle down for me. I had never had that belief in God. I'd never been militant about it one way or another. It was a non-issue with me. Because remember, I'm the only thing in my life. And God was something other people argued about. And I just stayed away from it. It just had no bearing whatsoever on my life. And I'd never really given it much thought. And I would say at some point, at one time, it did offend me a little bit to be forced to pray. You know, and I used to sit there, man, I'm sick of prayer, you know. And I see people do that all the time. And I think a real breaking point was when I decided to pray just so I didn't offend you. I was more worried about you being offended than me being offended. And that was growth. And I started sponsoring people a couple of years into it. I almost went back out early on, and that's because my current wife, I asked her out at 8 or 10 months. And she asked her sponsor. And her sponsor said, don't touch him with a 10-foot pole. And that offended me. Resentment, man. I tell you, who are these AA people who want to run my life, you know? Well, who are they that tell me what to do, you know? And then they're looking out for me. You know, at 8 months over, I don't need any distractions. And what her sponsor was telling, get out of his way. Let him do what he needs to do, and then maybe later you can do that. And I guess somewhere about a year we went out, and we've been married 11 years now, I think. And she has just celebrated 30 years of sobriety. And in a lot of AA things, I keep her out of my AA life in some aspects, but in other ones, she's got a world of experience that I tap all the time. Particularly in traditions and group functions and stuff like that. She's pretty wise about that. But I started sponsoring people, and the first ones were the hardest people to sponsor. And that's who was attracting me, and that's who I was attracted to. And none of them got sober. And I was single then. I'd keep them at my house. I used to have a Joe and Charlie big book meeting at my house, and my house got broken into and stuff stolen and traded for drugs. And all this stuff started happening, and had the one sponsee kill himself. Just kept at it. It was a little bit discouraging. But I started having some success. And I sort of developed, I've been all the way through the steps. The only thing I haven't done in the steps is I got one or two amends out there. And one of them is one that I really have resisted. This guy did me wrong, man. He did me wrong in a big way. And he really did. And I did him wrong right back. And he's lived in Argentina since I've gotten sober. So I'm like, well, that ain't going to happen. And but he's moved back to Charlottesville here recently. And I'm pretty much a believer that God will put him there when I'm supposed to do it. And that's been the way it's been. And this whole thing about God, I really came strong to believe at about year two or three. It just came to me, I say gradually, but then it seems like it was pretty sudden. And it's pretty clear to me that I couldn't get sober on my own. I couldn't do it. You couldn't get me sober. People in my life who I loved dearly couldn't get me sober. People with extreme authority over me couldn't get me sober. And there was no way for me to get sober, yet here I sit. I have no other explanation for that. I started praying. Remember, I was going to do anything to stay sober, and I did. It's suggestions were given to me, and I did them. I don't know if some of them helped or not, but one thing was they said to pray. I read the big book, The First Two Nights of Detox, and God, I was looking for the loopholes. I really did not want to be an alcoholic. When they started describing the hard drinker, I'm like, yes, 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 hard drinker. Because, you know, a hard drinker can possibly drink again at some point here, you know. And only an alcoholic would think that. And but I read it all, and it was all too familiar. The stories, Bill's stories, more about it. Jim was nailing me. Just think, it was very depressing. But really realizing about what was going on with me there. But I read that whole big book, and I started praying, and I didn't know what to do. I didn't really believe in anything. So I just sit there in my bedroom at night feeling like crap, you know, and it's like, all right, you know, I don't know if anything's up there. Don't know who you are, what you are, even if you're hearing me. I need a hand here, you know. Can you help me get through tonight without taking a drink? And I did. Wasn't pretty, but I did. So I did it the next day, and I'm still doing it. I still do that prayer every day. And then looked around and tried to help other people. That's something I always did. I did some outside AA stuff, too, because I just didn't know what was going to work at first. And over the years, some of it sloughed off. But that very core of what was going on when I got sober is still there. And I absolutely insist on maintaining that. And I've had a little resentment with my church because they have something else they think would work for me. And that's the only thing. And I just, sorry. And I really don't expect non-alcoholic people to understand why I need to be here and do the things I do. I just know I need to do them. And, you know, I may respect you, admire you, and love you to death, but if you're going to lead me away from what's working, I'm not going to listen to you. And that's just sort of the way it is. And don't mean to belittle anybody, but that's what I have to do. And I've watched these people that I've sponsored, and quite a few of them have stayed sober. And I do the same thing with all of them now. I go into the book, and we go through the book, and when we get to the step, we work it. And we keep at it until we finish it. And I've tried a bunch of different stuff, but that seems to be what works the best for me and has the highest percentage of success. Had a lot of experience. I'm a few minutes from finishing here, but a lot of stuff about sponsorship that I've learned over the years and witnessed, and haven't been doing as much of it lately just because I live out in the middle of nowhere and there's just not that many opportunities. My wife really is my motivation to go to church. That used to be my travel day into the city to cruise for newcomers. I'd go into meetings and troll for them, you know, and you got a sponsor. You got a sponsor. And because I need them. Got to have them. And there's just been something. There's one guy, I was talking at a meeting here recently about when to give and not to give and what, you know, other people in AA. And over the years, I've given money, I think, twice. And one was a sponsee. He was well grounded in AA, was having employment issues, and he wanted a cell phone. He had no credit. And so what do you need a cell phone for? You know, I'm thinking this is a pretty trivial thing. And he says, well, I got all these guys that are calling me, you know, that I sponsor, and, you know, they can't reach me. And because I'm hardly ever at home, and I'm like, you need a cell phone. And so, you know, I ponied up the deposit to get him the cell phone. And, you know, because he's just, I helped him. I didn't get him sober, but I helped him get there. He would tell you different. He thinks I did it. But he's turned around and he's sponsoring way more people than I am. And it's just really incredible to watch. You know, y'all know what that's about. But and I know so many people that the really depressing thing is that, you know, I'm not from up around here, so it wouldn't apply here, but I can go into meetings where I got sober, and there's a lot of the people that I got sober with that aren't around. I know what happened to some of them. Some of them moved, actually, but some of them went back out. And of all that group that was with me early on, there's one guy who got sober 3 days before me that's still sober. And I always know his anniversary. I got to see him. We went to Minneapolis in 2000 to the International Convention, and that's where he was living then. And I got together and had dinner with him. And I've done a lot of that, you know, going to the conventions and stuff like that. I've done about every job you can do in a home group. Like some of it, didn't like other parts of it, but did it anyhow. And never hurts you to do something you don't like. You might learn something. And so I hope that's pretty much it. But I, you know, the part about who I was and what I've become, it's just stark to me. I hope y'all caught on to that. Because being a parent was not in the cards. Wasn't going to live that long, for one thing. And nobody's going to let me near a child when I was drinking. And the level that my employer, the kind of trust they put in me. I ran for political office a couple of years ago. And this thing about God's will, I act on that all the time. And I'm constantly looking for it. And I felt like I was being led to run for public office. Anybody who knows me thinks that's ludicrous. Because I just don't have it in me. You know, it's just, there's nothing in my personality that would make me good at that. And I tell the truth. You know, cynicism there. But I felt like I was supposed to do that. And I was cuffed on a campaign all summer. After work, I'd put on my little campaign uniform and get in the truck and go door to door and talk to these total strangers. And every day I did that, I'm like, are you sure, God, that I'm supposed to do this? So I really didn't want to do it. I got better stuff to do with my time. Lost by 16 votes. And best thing that ever happened to me, really. And and to this day, I don't know why I was led to do that. I am sure there was some sort of purpose there. Somebody that I ran into, somebody that observed something I was doing. Don't know why, just knew I was supposed to do it, and I did it. My part of it's done. Don't plan to do it again, but I guess. All right, that pretty much finished me up.